From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Welcome to episode 79 of The Dice Men Cometh, broadcasting live from the studios of Edge Radio 99.3 FM on the 23rd of July 2015 in Hobart. Your hosts for the evening for this conversation about tabletop games, three men who have never won second prize in a beauty contest.
Or collected the $10.
I did win a chicken once.
How was that?
It was my first ever win on a chocolate wheel.
You won a chicken on a chocolate wheel.
Not a live chicken.
That's all kinds of wrong.
My chocolate chicken?
Trent.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Garth.
And what is happening tonight? Please, Mark, don't
we have got another fully packed out show. We've got a very exciting interview with a local Tassie man who's developed a role-playing game that is genre-bending. Not gender-bending. Genre-bending.
Oh, Mark.
Come on, you're Thymon Thetathick.
It could be gender-bending as well, I don't know.
I think that was a Freudian penis from Mark right there.
We are also going to talk about what we've been playing. We're going to talk about teaching games and the fear that comes in with that. We are going to talk about iOS games.
We are.
All that and lots more tonight on the show.
But look, as always, we just have to get things started on the right note. With sheer naked rage from Pantera. A blast of energy from the not too distant past, Pantera. And it starts us off tonight on The Dice Men Cometh.
That was solid. That was very solid.
It's Edge Radio 99.3 FM with Trent, Mark and Garth talking nerdy to you. It must be Thursday night.
Indeed.
Have we been playing anything lately, boys
and
girls?
Surprisingly enough, we've been playing a game.
Yeah.
This game is called 51st State, and it's by our very good friend and maybe one of our new favourite designers, it's hard to say, Ignace Trevicek. He's been going berserk with this game, 51st State. Now, obviously, he created Robinson Crusoe, which is a favourite of ours, and then the follow-up or the re-implementation of this, Imperial Settlers.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that 51st State is not a game that has gone berserk, but Ignace's design career in the board gaming industry has.
Yes.
But this is a very early iteration.
Yeah, so this is a game from 2010, and actually a lot of people say this game is set in the universe of Naroshima Hex, whereas in fact Portal Games, which is Ignace's company in Poland, they actually created an RPG called Naroshima that then was used to set the game Naroshima Hex in, which they created, which has been a popular little sort of risk type game.
Yeah.
I haven't actually played it, and apparently it's hard to get, but that and this are in the same post-apocalyptic world where, bled out by years of ruthless conflict over resources, terrorized by rebellious machines, and burnt to the ground by weapons of mass destruction, the US has turned into a barren wasteland. However, while the old 50 states are now nothing more than borderlines on pre-war maps, the idea of a new 51st state, there's an idea for a name, a beacon of hope for a human civilization, fires the imagination of leaders and simple people like us alike.
Can I tell you guys that I got all confused about the title of this game and had to go onto Wikipedia to go, how many states are there in the United States?
I think there's 52, aren't there?
Well, it depends on what's a state and what's a territory or province, and Puerto Rico comes into it.
Well, we did talk about Puerto Rico a while ago, didn't we?
Anyway, a game from Portal Games. Plays 2 to 4 in 40 to 90 minutes, suggested ages 10 and up, and people have said that it's probably best with 2 or 3, which is surprising, because we played with 4. It brings together card drafting and hand management. You've sort of got variable player powers, in that your starting powers are a little bit different.
Yeah, well, you've got your starting species or races. Yeah. You've got the 4, you've got the mutants, you've got the traders, then the New Yorkers.
Yeah.
And also the Appalachians.
The Appalachian Federation.
Because each of them...
We're like a big boy.
Exactly. Look, basically, each of them are trying to take over and create this 51st state, aren't they?
That's
They're trying
right.
to be the dominant force. And look, straight off the bat, I like the theme.
Yeah, well, look, let me tell you a little bit about it. So with the game, you basically, you've got a little bit at the start where you're drawing some new cards, and there's a bit of a drafting mechanism, the lookout phase. Look out! Then you're doing your resource production, where you're producing the resources that you've got on your cards. And obviously, as you add new cards, you can produce new things. Then you've got the meat of it, really, which is the action phase. This is where it gets a little bit confusing, because depending on what you're using a card for, you can conquer a location, you can negotiate with an outpost, you can incorporate a location, redevelop a location, you can play a new leader, you can send workers to your locations or your opponent's locations. These are all the things. And there's this very interesting mechanic where each card can basically be used three different ways.
Each card can do all of these things, and yep. there's all kinds of different iconography on there, depending on which of these things you want to do. And frankly, I did find that to be a little bit of a problem with this game. The iconography is a little bit clunky.
Yes, and look, a lot of the reviews I read... that was the biggest problem, is there's too much iconography and it's too much to get your head around to learn the game. Now, I struggled a bit with the terminology, because they were talking about how to use these cards in the three different ways. And now, so one way is you basically burn a card and you get stuff as a once-off.
Well, that's called an invasion.
That's right.
You invade that card, which sort of thematically is you go somewhere, you take some loot and you run away.
And
it's a one-off. Generally a pretty good return on your investment. You might get a lot of resources, but then they're gone.
Yeah, and then the second way is you can establish a negotiation, which is the area provides resources each turn during the production phase, but you're getting much less than you are when you're doing the burn and pillage strategy, but it's going to last you through the turn. And then the third one is you
build something.
Yeah, you incorporate a location into your tableau, if you like, and you get to use that power every turn. It costs you more to do it. It's more difficult to do it. And the other bit of this that really confused me was this whole distance thing. So each card has a distance number on it, and you've got to be able to send your stuff in whichever of the various ways you do it out this certain level of distance.
Now, I need to say straight away that I didn't find this too hard. And I'll explain why, Mark, is because the distances go 1, 2, or 3. and I'm, like, middle-aged now, which pains me to say, but I must say thank you to both my primary and high school teachers, because I was able to differentiate what was a 1, a 2, or a 3. So after Trent, maybe not expertly, but you know, competently explained it to
me,
I understood... that if I had a 1, do you not want to guess how far I could go? I could go 1 distance. Okay. And look, I understand that, you know, maybe I'm gifted. I don't know.
Okay, so the thing that was confusing about it was when I look at my powers, I was the mutants, of course, mutant and proud. I look and I go, okay, I can use fuel to go 2 distance. At that stage, though, I had no idea at all. Well, how the hell am I going to get fuel to go 3 distance? I didn't understand about those little extra little tokens you can get. Because I could fight for 3 distance because I was a mutant, but I couldn't be peaceful for 3 distance, and I couldn't really work it out. And the whole concept of location, because you're not putting these cards out at different distances from your home board, I just think it was confusing. And I guess that's one of the points where the... new version of the game, Imperial Settlers, the re-implementation, tosses the whole idea of distance out the window and basically says you've got to have these resources to build this place.
They're not really that similar, these two games.
Well, they've completely basically abandoned the idea of distance, and it's just about resources, and I really like that.
Well, I would say that what 51st State has done is it has the distance, and you know, I think... I was lucky. We had played Imperial Settlers before, so walking into 51st State, I felt a bit more comfortable. But I think Imperial Settlers has gone more resource-heavy in that there's a lot more stuff to collect, which is compensating for the distance mechanic.
You're absolutely correct. But I really liked it. I guess it was much simpler to keep track of that, whereas because of having played the other game, which didn't have distance, I was then working out what is this distance and how... it bears no resemblance to how the other game works. That's where I struggled with it, I guess.
Sure. Look, that's completely fair enough. And look, Trent and I played this a couple of times in a night. And
you really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it. And I'll tell you why. I really liked the theme. I thought the theme suited the mechanic. And the fact that unlike Imperial Settlers, where there's a lot of interaction, and this is weird for me because I usually love that kind of stuff, I really enjoyed the fact that I was able to build my own sort of town, my own civilization. Okay. Because both times we played it, I don't think there was even a card that allowed us to interact with each other's tableau building.
Yeah, yeah. There's not a huge amount of interaction with that. And I think that adds to sort of my overall opinion, which is that it's good, but it's not great.
Well, the thing is, I like the fact that it is shorter. You know, we played it in probably about half the time that we played Imperial Settlers, and I think that's a sweet spot.
But oh my God, this post-apocalyptic theme just makes me want to stab myself in the eye.
Yes, but
this is so boring.
This did it years and years and years ago. There's been a lot of games between this game and now.
Yeah, and it's very much a sort of my first game from Ignace. I think... A hint of his future promise, perhaps, if you want to look at it
and
that
way. And he's definitely
way.
Living up to that, that's for sure.
To play it, it really just comes down to a race to find some of the best combos, so it's all down to the luck of the card draw, yep. I think, but it's a perfectly acceptable way to spend 40 minutes.
I think so too, and I think there's a couple of the expansions that came out for it, which does add a bit of variety and a bit of change of strategy
and
to
I
it.
Nearly won a game.
You did, and you were almost there, but not quite. And
look, I'll just jump in. I liked it. I'd more than happily play it again. Out of the two, I'd certainly pick Imperial Settlers, but I quite liked it. The theme's a bit ho-hum, but yeah, look, it's a fairly quick game, and it's a good variation, I guess, in card games.
A thumbs up from Garth.
Definitely.
Two semis.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Well, look, I think we've got to understand that this is probably almost a filler. It probably plays in half an hour if you have played it before. Because it just as a two player, it flows a lot quicker. I think that's where its sweet spot is. Okay. It's not a night game. Whereas Imperial Settlers, it's more of a let's sit down and do this over a couple of
Although
hours.
Although I think if we played Imperial Settlers again and had the rules down, that would play a lot quicker as well.
That's 51st State. But up next, we're talking Power Frame, which is a Tasmanian made RPG available on Drive-Thru RPG. It's a modular RPG system that can be used. Look, it can be as mad, as complex, or as simple as you want, set anywhere that you want. And we'll talk to the designer, Craig Judd, next on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. This is The Dice Men Cometh.
That was Jim Wise by Sun Kill Moon, and you are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3.
Isn't he the head of the United Nations?
Well, maybe on his side gig. Ah. But anyway, Trent was lucky enough to speak to another...
You're so unhip, the two of you. Neither of you have any idea what's going on.
Well, he's got a replacement hip. That must make him extra hip. But anyway, Trent, you were lucky enough to speak to Craig Judd, who's a local Tasmanian RPG designer from Tropical North Tasmania. Would you like to... play that button.
Craig Judd joins us now from the northern half of the island of Taswija in a little town called Devonport. He's got himself onto the Drive-Thru RPG website with his game Power Frame, a homemade indie RPG available now on, it's the world's biggest RPG store, and Craig is going to tell us all about it. Good evening, Craig. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Look, it's a pleasure. Don't be nervous. I know it's your first podcast interview, but we're always happy to hear it when people in our backyard are kicking some goals. So congratulations on the completion of the game, first up.
Thank you. Yep, that took a while.
Yes, we might get to that. Let's start by trying to explain what Power Frame is, though. It's an anime-inspired universal action toolbox, modular... Yep. Multi-genre mashup. Actually, most of those are your words, Craig. What the bloody hell does all that mean?
It's a system I put together because I was basically in the mid-90s. I was coming up with my own settings, and I used other games to sort of come up with the rule sets for them and to run games in these weird mashup things. But I thought it would be easier if I just made my own game, which did things the way I wanted it to. It's designed to be fairly simple, although I think it's one of those games that starts out simple and then you kind of build bits onto it and it keeps expanding. It's designed to be consistent across genres, so if it handles guns and bows and things, and you can have everything in the same...
Everything on all at once, all together.
Yeah, you can do. Yeah. It's probably not advisable usually, but yeah.
Well, look, let's establish your RPG cred. You're obviously a long-time gamer, and you're quite involved with Australia's indie RPG scene. Yes, in fact, you're doing some work on something tonight.
Well, actually, it was for the American RPG scene. I'm doing there's a game called Neurosia, the Sea of Tears, which got kickstarted in 2012. It's kind of been held up in layout for about 6 months now, and the guy in charge, or the guy who wrote it, Shane Harsh, got in contact. Have you got some time over the next couple of weeks? Because I want to get this finished in time for Gen Con. So yeah, 2 weeks to do a couple of hundred pages of layout. So 28 days later, it's finally been handed in.
Yeah, but you're a graphic designer by trade, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. I moved to Devonport a couple of years ago now, and gave up my job to move in with my fiance. So I've kind of been looking for work ever since. Freelance RPG work has been my biggest money spinner so far.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And, of course, God bless the internet, because you can work on anything anywhere. So, yeah. Well, look, back to Power Frame. It seems to be a fairly light system. It's got some wacky dice rolling going on. Now, you yourself have described the rules as not particularly groundbreaking, which is maybe underselling it. So what is different about Power Frame?
Its unique selling points, I guess, is the toolbox nature of it, the fact that everything's built with it consistently. It uses a fairly stripped back sort of effects based system, so you can just describe things based on what they do.
Let's talk about the core ability mechanic that you've got in here and the dice roll around it, because I love the idea of this. You get to roll a d6 and you add it to your ability score in order to pass a challenge.
It doesn't get much more simple than that.
Well, you've managed to mix it up a little bit. If you roll a 6, you roll a bonus die and you add that. But if you roll a 1, the 1 effectively becomes a minus sign and you subtract your next d6 from your ability instead. I call that cruelty at its simplest.
Yeah, rolling a 1 isn't looked on favorably, but a lot of systems that I won't name that use d20s, you sort of have this effect where it doesn't matter how competent your character is or how high level and, you know, powerful they are, 5% of the time if you roll a 1, you stuff it up.
Yeah.
And get a critical failure or just fails to work. It doesn't matter. But in Power Frame, even though you do subtract stuff, you only get, there's like a margin on the critical failures. So you can only get a critical failure if you roll a particularly low value, which is -3 normally. So your abilities all start at 0. And you've just got a big list of abilities. There's no separation between skills and stats. They go up to 5 usually, although you can take them higher. If you're a non-human or a robot or something like that. But for normal people, it can go up to 5. And if you roll a d6 and subtract your roll, if you roll a 1, the worst you can get if you've got a 5 is a -1. So, and even from the start, if you've got a couple of points in it, it cuts down your chances of getting critical failures.
I always enjoy the point buy system for character generation. You're using something like that here, and you mentioned that you allow people to build their own spells, build their own weapons, but you've gone a step further. You're allowing them to, with the point buy system, create their own classes, their own races. Is that not just a recipe for disaster for the GM?
Well, I've got a pretty open sort of GMing style, I guess. If you do go all out, which I pretty much have done in the last game that I started running of Power Frame, we kind of went with it end up getting described? It was like a post-apocalyptic techno-gothic something or other. But we've got we've got PCs, the guys are making them, and they've mostly just been playing D&D and Pathfinder before, so they're used to sort of, you know, class and level-based stuff. We started out with, they're basically playing gothic monsters in a post-apocalyptic world, like Vampire Hunter D sort of thing.
Sure, why not?
We were making characters, and it's like a werewolf, but he wanted to have, he just sort of jokingly, the player said, well, how about I have like lightsaber claws? And everyone's like, yeah. And then I was like, yeah, I can do that. But how do they work exactly? I mean, do you have like lightsaber projectors built into your fingertips, or do you have like these knuckle dusters? So, yeah, it's we ended up with that werewolf. We've got a vampire who's using a chainsword, and we ended up with a demon that can change size up to, I think, about 33 meters tall.
Uh-oh.
So that's and grow wings. So yeah, it's interesting. So you can go all out pretty much with it, and you know, the sky's the limit.
Because on the one hand, this does sound so simple and easy to understand that it's almost kid friendly, and yet there's theoretically no restriction on things. So that could be a little bit intimidating for a first-time GMer.
It's probably about as crunchy as Savage Worlds when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's that it looks simple on the base, but there's a lot of fiddly parts. If you get into all the subsystems, you can, as I said, sort of strip it back and limit things and just say, okay, we won't use the critical hits, we won't use these other optional rules, and just we'll basically just go off the basic rules, which is how I ran the very first game of it.
Craig, is it true that you have been working on Power Frame for 19 years?
that isn't really part of my marketing spiel. Oh, 19 years in development.
But I guess that's from the beginning when this first started. It's just a bit of a home-cooked mashup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was the mid-90s. Everything was crazy. It's basically a distillation of that sort of era. So a couple of the reasons that I wrote it was I was frustrated with the ways some of the other systems we were using did things. Like, I'd noticed there were rules missing. And there weren't obvious ways to figure out how to do something. So I thought, I'll write a system which nails it all down, which tells me exactly how to do it, and it does it the way that I want it to. It does get into a bit of a rabbit hole sort of situation if you keep going down that way. You can sort of say, okay, well, I need rules for everything. So, you know, rule for this and rule for that. Eventually, it turns into system bloat.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, you decided not to kickstart this game. Can you tell us why you opted against that? Because obviously it's a hugely popular way of launching a lot of properties now.
I decided when I started developing this particular version of the game, of the document, I aimed it squarely at PDF because, you know, it's an easy way to get something out there. When I was first writing up the good versions, you know, what traditional print runs were just beyond the reach of a gamer that's only going to sell a couple of hundred copies at best.
Mm.
So I aimed it squarely at PDF, and I looked at Kickstarter as an option because it was the big new thing. Talked to a couple of communities on Google Plus about it, and to the people who were interested in the game. I decided against kickstarting because I didn't actually need to pay anyone for anything. I've done the writing, obviously, but I also did the art and the layout because I'm a graphic artist. So I didn't need to outsource any parts of it, really, unless I wanted to get other people to draw stuff for it. And it did take me a year to finish off all the pictures after the writing was done, so maybe I should have done that.
Yes, and we should say that some of your work is in print in various systems. Can you run us through some of the other systems that you've lent a hand with, Craig?
There's Fear the Living, which is a fairly small print indie zombie game. That was my first big freelance layout project that I helped out with. There's Neurosia, the Sea of Tears, which should be out soonish. What else have I done? I've done some art for a game called Strays, which is a Fate accelerated supplement or setting book sort of thing. I don't think that's actually out yet, though.
You did some editing with Fragged Empire as well, yes, which is another Australian project. Yeah,
I did a little bit. I helped out with the sort of pre-Kickstarter or during the Kickstarter. I helped out a bit with the couple of stories on the website.
So, what is the plan from here? You've mentioned a print-on-demand version of Power Frame.
Yeah.
You've left settings and scenarios wide open as well. Are you going to be providing any scenarios or any supplements to this in the future?
Yeah, I've got some interesting ideas. There's a lot of material, obviously, from the like nearly 20-year backlog of stuff that I've been running it for, which I could sort of prep and get out there. It's a matter of figuring out what people actually want, though.
Mm.
There's probably going to be a need for more comprehensive bestiary than the one I've got in the core book, though.
Sounds like you need people to get in and start playing then, mate.
I've got some interesting ideas for scenarios and adventures. I tend to run stuff very a little bit sandbox, sort of not. I don't use linear adventures very much where I know what's going to happen. You know, I set up situations and sort of run with them and see what happens. I think I've noticed what's lacking in the RPG market at the moment is it's adventures that that set up situations rather than just giving you a list of encounters to follow.
Sure, something that's not on railroads. Yeah.
Yeah, but I want to try and put something together that's kind of short that you can pick up and maybe slot into your existing campaign world, maybe not necessarily for Power Frame, but for other things, other games as well, and something that's easy and quickish to pick up so you don't have to read for, you know, 4 hours before you can actually start using it.
Oh, amen to that. All right, well, if you want to dabble yourself in a little mashup world building with some Japanime streetscapes and post-apocalyptic chibi battles, get yourself to Drive Through RPG and check out Power Frame from right here in Tassie. Craig Judd from Devonport, mate, congratulations and best of luck with it.
Great, thank you very much.
Cool, very nice chat, Trent, well done.
It's going off in Devonport.
Woo! It sure is. Mark, how about we play a song and then I can tell you all about iOS?
That sounds like a really great idea, Garth. Let's do that now. Oh, yeah. Black, I guess was the next word. That was Fade to Black by Peak Body, a local Tassie act. You're with Edge Radio 99.3 FM. We are the Dice Men Cometh. Trent and Mark, and this guy over here is going to tell us all about computer games, iOS games, Android games, toilet games.
Exactly right. Oh, I thought I was going to have a soundtrack, Mark, but you just disappoint me again and again and again. Anyway, just repeating the news that you broke last week, Mark. There we go. Seven Wonders, the app. It was now in open beta for about a minute and a half before it got closed because so many people wanted to jump into it. So it was closed in English, closed in French, and closed in German when I looked. There's still no word at all on a release date, but this is a promising sign for an app that has been talked about for ages. Yeah. Every single time anyone mentions there's a new app version of any game, it's about the third comment, what about Seven Wonders, or what about Through the Ages? They're the two games that everyone wants to know about.
And the iOS implementation of Seven Wonders, does it include any of the expansions or is it just the base game at this point when it's being trialed?
They will be in-app purchases.
Sure figures. I suppose it's a little bit disappointing because it is a game that requires some bookkeeping, some counting.
Yes.
But as you pointed out earlier in the show, for most of us who have the ability to count to five...
I'm only talking to three.
Well, that's right. Yeah. It should be fine.
Well, it should be, but again, you know, just the joy of being able to sit down on the toilet and have a game of Seven Wonders.
And not have to talk to anybody, which I suppose is what some people want to do.
It's fantastic.
Or not want to do.
Hang on, I've missed something here.
What?
Five?
In Seven Wonders.
Are you counting to seven?
Well, yeah, but you're counting the little icons, aren't you? Seven, five...
Anyway, so we'll move on. Now,
have I mentioned that I've never won a game of Seven Wonders?
But you are hosting five tournaments. So anyway, one of the biggest apps from last year had a major update. So that was Galaxy Trucker. It's now got missions. Now, it's only available when you have the app and you go into multiplayer, which means you're playing against real people on the other side of the internet. But what it does is it breaks the rules of the game. So it allows... these missions are basically, you know, things like you'll be carrying explosives and... The whole point is to be able to do the mission while having enough of your ship actually break apart, but have enough of your ship to still get back to the final destination with those little cubes that you're carrying. Doesn't that sound interesting?
It sounds fun. I don't want to be on the mission when clearly you're on the prison ship and you get stabbed in the showers with the explosives.
The joy of it is it just adds more variety to an otherwise really, really cool implementation. You know, it's a fun game, full stop. It's a really great implementation. And this is just mixing it up, giving it a bit more variety, which is really, really cool. And again, similar to what Splendor did, which is offered you a campaign mode that would break the rules and teach you to play the game a slightly different way. Galaxy Trucker is doing this as well, which I thought was a really nice implementation. Mm. I've been getting alerts every 2 days because every 2 days they release a new mission for you to jump on and have a go of.
That's very annoying. You can turn those off.
Yeah, but it's every 2 days.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's not like RSVP or Tinder or anything like that sort of just goes constantly beep, beep, beep. So I hear.
Does it, Garth?
I don't know. So
tell
another
us
game
more about these games.
Another game that has been massive in our hobby and is now not quite available, but in beta, is Steam by Martin Wallace.
Oh.
Now this game is right up your alley, Trent, because it's all about trains.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, you excited about this? So you build railroads, you deliver goods, you're moving along the networks of tracks that you build, you're trying to upgrade those tracks and trains and upgrade your towns.
I might be a complete nerd, but at least I'm not a train enthusiast. I've held that out there all my life, right? And now, trains in my hobby.
There you go.
I'm pretty sure it was close to an anorak what he was wearing when he walked into the studio tonight,
definitely.
Wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, but look, I mean, it's number 52 on Board Game Geek as a board game. It's very, very highly regarded. So I think you should sort of try this, Trent. And we may also be playing Trains tonight, Mark.
And Steam, look, Steam is a dumbed-down version of Age of Steam, so it is right up your alley.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, moving on.
So anyway, I've applied to be in the beta. We'll see whether they got my email. Otherwise, it's lost in the mail. But otherwise, it looks really cool. They released some new screenshots. I'm really looking forward to having a go at that. I think it'll be a very nice implementation. And obviously, Martin Wallace is a fantastic designer. So, we should be A-OK. Another one, which was the Origins 2015 Best Historical Board Game winner, Heroes of Normandy. That is also in an open beta. So that is going to be out in the not-too-distant future. That's sort of like almost a hex-based, you equated it. Oh, what did you equate it to when you were announcing it as historical board game winner?
It's a lot like it's got the historical accuracy of a John Wayne movie.
Yeah, something like that. So anyway, the point being
it's
it'll be a great
kind
game.
Of, that kind of cheesy World War II art. Yeah.
Exactly. But it lends itself onto an iPad or an electronic device really, really nicely. So I think that'll be a good implementation. And then the biggest update lately is that Hearthstone has had another massive expansion called Grand Tournament. It releases 130 plus new cards, new heroes, new abilities, new everything. This game is a behemoth, Mark, or yes. A behemoth. So, look, it's massive in the hobby. People will go and get this game and they will download it again and they will buy the little booster packs and they will do all this and they will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars because that's what Blizzard Entertainment earns a crap ton of money on.
And have you played it, Garth?
I have. I play it and I really, really like
it. Yeah.
I think it's a great game. You can play a game in about 10 minutes. It takes absolutely no time to link up with another person in the lobby. Generally, the matches are pretty even if you're playing the casual games. If you're going into the leagues and what have you, you can just get absolutely obliterated by someone who's spending more money than you, which is fair enough. But I really, really enjoy it. For a quick little card-playing game, it's a lot of fun, and I can understand why it's been so, so, so successful.
Ah.
Yeah, so, look, in terms of the last update I wanted to give, it's more the game that has now been moved onto iPad, which I played a lot of, and I really enjoyed it. It's called This War of Mine, and it's taking the whole war perspective in games and putting it on the helpless individual. So you start in a absolutely decrepit little house with a couple of survivors, and all you've got to do is survive. Now,
is it post-apocalyptic?
It's not necessarily. It's sort of in that nondescript, non-named Eastern Bloc country scenario. But it's beautiful art. It's black and white, almost pencil-drawn art. And it's such a simple idea for a game in that all you're trying to do is survive. You've got to go out. Sorry, during the day, all you're trying to do is focus on your four walls. All you're doing is keeping your people happy. You're trying to, filter water. Woo! You're trying to, patch up holes. You're trying to, just make sure everyone's happy. And then at night, one of these people, and only one at a time, can go out and forage and try and find some stuff. And that's where the game becomes really, really tense. Ooh. Because you're going to different locations. You might go to a church or a school or another apartment block. And that's where the something can hit the fan because you just don't know what you're going for. And all you're trying to do is maybe get some food, get some supplies, And it's so tense and so hard. And I know, Trent, your wife...
Oh, yeah.
She, I was going to say, it does sound like the Walking Dead games.
She was absolutely hooked on this for a long time. It's not based on a board game.
No.
But I suppose it could be.
Well, there's a lot of games in this sort of genre.
Yes.
You know, in terms of not necessarily post-apocalyptic, but in, you know, that war-torn state.
Yeah, yeah, and you're just going out foraging for resources, and somehow it's really gripping.
Yeah.
Especially when you go out foraging and you run into some other strangers who are out doing the same thing. My wife got absolutely hooked on this and just played it to death.
Yep.
If you like that thing where you're trying to manage really scarce resources with multiple characters, almost like a solo co-op in a way, then this will be right up your alley, this War of Mine.
Exactly. It's fantastic. It's not cheap. It's about, I think, $12.
It's worth it, though.
But it is. It's fantastic. It's so much fun. And the number of conversations that I had with your wife where she goes, my people have survived for 30 days and I haven't had to kill anybody. You know, it's that kind of stuff. It's storytelling and it's done so beautifully. All the characters have a backstory so you can read about them. And it also tells you what keeps them ticking. So you need to go and find some cigarettes because this guy's a smoker.
It is even quite thought-provoking in its way.
Right. And that's all I've got to talk about in terms of electronic gaming.
It sounds very, need I say, interesting, actually.
It is. Do you feel like I've taught you how to play this game, though?
I almost do, but look, it sounds, I hate to say it, but it sounds a bit tricky.
Oh, my God. This speech is my recital.
I wish you could have seen Trent and heard Trent then rapping away, of course, to Run DMC and Tricky, because it is tricky to rock a rhyme that's right on time. It is tricky.
People always tear on what I'm wearing. Tricky, I think they're tricky, going too tricky. Far. There was a brief moment in between board games where I was a little white boy rapper in about 1988-89 when the Raising Hell album was out. Beastie Boys, License to Ill, the first Public Enemy album, old school rap, an 808 drum machine and an attitude, and that's all you needed.
It was great times. We're on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh and Run DMC and our 80s hip-hop and board games.
Yeah.
And you know what else is tricky is learning new games. Well, and in fact, teaching new games.
You've been wanting to talk about this for a little while, Mark, because you know, we have a lot of new games coming across our table all the time. And Mark, you occasionally bring one in, and you always seem to get a little bit deer in the headlights when we ask you to explain these things. It's almost like you don't kind of enjoy the process of learning them.
I do find it very trepidatious.
Ooh,
that's my word for the day. And you know, I feel like I'm having conniptions when I'm learning it. Because I just have...
When you're learning it or when you're explaining it?
Well, both. That's the thing. Like, I have this... When I analyze it, when I psychoanalyze it, I have this threefold fear. So I have the fear of teaching it badly and making mistakes.
Okay, sure. So fear of failure.
Yeah, and people think I'm an idiot.
Okay.
Trust me, Mark, you don't need to worry about that.
Yeah, that's right. Then I have the fear that because I've taught it badly... People would go, oh, this is a crap game, where in fact it's mostly an amazing game.
So people
are going to miss out on that fantastic experience of that game.
Fear of letting the designer down?
Yeah.
Of misrepresenting it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, most of these games are brilliant, and it burns me up.
So fear of failure again, times two,
yes,
right?
And then, because these days my game time is so limited...
Yeah.
You know, by what's going on in my life, just so much happening, I get such little game time anyway. I don't want to waste it by giving a bad experience and getting a bad experience. So I have the fear of wasting the little time that I've got anyway, and it's almost paralyzing.
That's fear of failure times three.
Okay.
Oh, Mark, I had no idea it was that hard on you. But you know, this is an interesting thing about our hobby, and I mean, board games are more popular now, arguably, than what they maybe ever have been.
Is it perhaps a golden age that we're in?
That's what they say. That's what they say. But there is something that stops the hobby from crossing over into the quote unquote mainstream, and we've talked about this on the show before, and that is rules.
Yes.
Right? the paralysis that, that people feel when they have to learn a bunch of, you know, do I hold four cards? Do I hold five cards? How many dice do I roll? What does a five mean again? And what's this weird little icon on the card? That paralyzes some yes. people. They don't want to actually spend their leisure time having to think too much. They'd rather just be spoon-fed with another episode of MasterChef, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But Mark, that's not you.
No.
And that's not you, man.
It's not. It's certainly not me. I want to invest the time into it, but I guess I'm scared of giving those that I'm trying to infect with this excitement and effervescence about this fantastic hobby we have, I'm scared of it going off the boil even.
You're uncomfortable with your role as an ambassador for the hobby.
Look, I have this characteristic. You may have noticed, but I'm a bit scatterbrained. I tend to go from here to there to everywhere. And really, the good way to teach a game, and look, there are some great resources out there. You know, there's Rado, Richard Ham and his playthroughs. You've got Watch It Play.
Yeah, with Rodney.
There's so many good videos and reviews. There was a great podcast called How to Play with Ryan Sturm, where he actually explains how to teach the games. There are so many great resources, but the main theme in all of them is sequentiality.
Yeah.
Mm.
And my brain is not wired for sequentiality. I am a scattergun man because I'm going to do a bit of this, bit of that, bit of this. What about that? What did you say? There goes a squirrel, you know, all that stuff.
Well, this is where I find, and I must credit a lot of game publishers and designers these days, is that they're putting the real quick player aid or turn sequence on the back of either their cards or their boxes or something like that, which does make it a hell of a lot easier to guide new players through this is what a turn looks like. Because I get you completely. I mean, and this is where, was it Universal Head that's put together a lot of those aids, which are just fantastic. And we've used them in a lot of our games. I think the last time we played the Epic Android session, you know, we all had our Universal Head player aids looking at them going, oh, yeah, that means that and that means that, which just makes the whole experience a lot simpler. But I do think that publishers and designers are trying and they're making a pretty good effort these days.
It's very easy to come into someone else's rule set
yes.
with a fresh set of eyes, whereas if you've been down in the trenches with it, developing it from the ground up, it's hard to be objective when you're trying to think how is somebody going to learn this. Mark, to come back to you, I think maybe the thing to do is maybe just teach it in the way that is most comfortable to you as well, because I think if you relax, then you're going to be able to convey it in a manner which is logical to you, be that ever so circuitous, and that enjoyment will come across, and that'll be the infection that you end up spreading.
Okay.
The infection of enjoyment.
Wow, that's beautiful. Now there is also another way I wanted to enlighten you, because over my years in my job, I've done a lot of sort of being talked to, I guess.
You know, you've listened a lot.
I've listened a lot, but I've also been able to cherry pick a few really good strategies, and a lot of that goes towards either public speaking or being able to build rapport, as they say. And one of the systems which does have a very simple rule set, I guess, which is nice, but it also makes sense for me personally.
This is something you've learned in the Church of Scientology, isn't it?
I'm just going to jump on up on a lounge. Yay! Go Tom Cruise style. No, not through Scientology. Through the Church of Board Gaming. But it's called Formats. Have you heard about Formats?
Formats.
Now, this is the number 4 and then MATS.
I was going to say, so it's like Formats.
Exactly right. And what it does is it breaks down basically any conversation into 4 main headings. And as long as you can keep them going, you'll be fine. So the first heading, which is always the first one you try and introduce, is why.
Yes.
Why are we here? Why are we playing this game?
And Let me take notes.
And it's not, why am I sitting in this fortress of awesome playing some games? It is, why are my meeples doing what they're meant to be? Why is my piece moving from there to there? So it's engaging. It's the story. It's the theme.
Ryan Sturm called it the hook.
Yeah. So it's the investment that people are going to have in this experience together. Now, once you've done that, you move on to the what. What are we doing that is going to take up the next couple of hours of our time? You know, we are going to be building a train line that goes from A to B.
Oh, God,
we are going to be fighting the evil forces of the fifth player in Descent.
That
we are going
better,
to be,
sounds better.
You know, we are going to be doing this. This is what we are going to be doing. And then that quite seamlessly moves into how are you going to do it?
Yes.
How are you going to do it is you're going to roll some dice. You're going to gather some resources. You're going to do the mechanics of your game. And then the last thing you're going to do, Mark, is you're going to come and you're going to overcome those objections. The what if. What if I do this? What if I do that? How does this happen? Blah, 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 which invariably happens. And I think I know a lot of times, and I'm very, very guilty of this, is that I go straight to, how do I break the game? How do I get that rule set that is might give me the advantage over someone else? But that's sort of the final step. And the real key to this, I think, is that if you ever get off the track, you always go back to why you're doing it. You're doing this because you need to achieve this in the game. You need to build that thing, or you need to slay that doodah, or you need to harvest those sheep, or whatever it is you're doing. It's a really simple mechanic. It works.
Look, the really interesting thing about
that
this...
That actually made sense.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? And look, I find this really interesting because I talk for a living, and I have no problems with that thing. So it's not my fear of talking. It's the process, and it's that these things do need to happen in an order. So look, I tell you what, I've got a game with me. You'll love it, Trent. It's about trains, but it's not a train game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a deck builder. I've got it in my car.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could play it tonight and I could try and explain it.
What's it called?
It's called Trains.
And what is it not about?
It's not about trains.
Okay.
All right. So, Mark, your job between now and when we get this to the table is figure out why.
Yeah.
Why the hell are we playing this game?
Yeah.
You know, I think it just comes down to, you know, when you're teaching something, I think confidence is everything. And
yes.
If you don't quite know your shit, right, then you're going to be on shaky ground.
And I think...
And so that just comes back to having the time to watch all those videos and get comfortable.
Also, the other thing is we because we're getting through so many games, we're only playing them once or twice and you don't get
the
chance to...
Well, that's the other problem with the hobby.
Have
There's
the level
so
of comfort.
Yeah. Much stuff to play. All right.
Okay. Now, a couple quick things before we go. Hobart Winter Games Fest coming up on the 8th and 9th.
Yes.
And but most importantly, our competition.
Yeah, we have just this minute finished filming our fourth video, which will be up online very, very shortly. You need to like this video if you want to get another entry into this awesome competition courtesy of Area 52. We've got Dead of Winter. We've got Sheriff of Nottingham. We've got Coup. We've got Love Letter ready to go. We've got a secret fifth prize. Are we allowed to talk about this yet, Mark?
Very quickly.
Yes. So we have got, Mark, I can't do it justice.
El Luchador, Fantastico Grande!
So we've got a new fifth prize ready to go. So get those entries in by liking, liking, liking. And that's all.
We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Like, like. Bye.
This has been an edit of The Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.